Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 38 million Americans suffer from migraines. Artist Priya Rama falls into the category of chronic migraine sufferers. That's just 1 or 2 million. So it's the most critical. They have always been with her, these migraines. They are extreme and they are debilitating. In her case, they're art. Priya Rama was among the 270 artists who participated in the 2018 Columbus Arts Festival. We saw her work and wanted to learn more about how art helps her cope with the migraines. Priya Rama, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
So the Columbus Arts Festival is curated. It's a big deal to get into the Columbus Arts Festival. Your work is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
And when I learned more about it, I was shocked that you actually make these paintings, you actually paint these creations while you're suffering from a migraine. And that's amazing to me.
Yes, I do. To be honest, I can say not every migraine I'm able to do it. It depends on the level of functionality.
Okay.
And I have really trained myself over time to do more and more and more. And my studio is at home right now, so it's very easy for me to get in and out of bed and create my art as I go along. So the more I paint, the more vivid and vibrant these images have started becoming. So it's actually, I look forward to it strangely in a way because I don't know what I'm going to see and to be able to capture that on canvas.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about art as a way to cope with migraines. My guest is Priya Rama. She is an artist. She was one of the 270 artists vetted for the Columbus Art Festival this year. And she paints when she has migraines, as she described. Not all of them. Some of them are too severe, but the colors become more vivid. If you want to see her work, we'll have a link to her website on our website. WSU.org, but you can also go online and see what's up in the studio right now. And you've also published a book of
Yes.
your work as well. Tell me first, when did you start to see art in your migraines?
I think I've always seen it, although I didn't really pay too much attention to it. I thought it was something that all migraineurs experienced. You've read reports about people seeing flashing lights mm-hmm. and such, but I didn't necessarily have those visual distortions. It was more what was happening inside my head.
When your eyes are closed?
When my eyes are closed and when the pain is fully underway. And I just thought that's part of the migraine process. And just slowly over time, I realized perhaps not that this is maybe a little bit more unique to me. And the fact that I'm an artist, like you said, and I have that background somehow comes through in what I see. And it got to a point where the chronic pain was just debilitating and I was over-medicating and I was just not in a good place. There's a lot of anger and frustration.
Yeah.
And I reached a point where I thought I needed to do something about it, sort of begin to heal inside out. And one of my migraines about 3-4 years ago was really, really vibrant and colorful. And I immediately decided to paint it. Because I have all the supplies ready mm-hmm. anyway. So that's what I did.
How does the depictions of your migraines differ from the kind of art you did before?
I did more traditional art before.
Landscapes, portraits. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Whereas this is art that I don't know how it's going to end up because I follow my inner voice in a way. And what's happened is with painting while having a migraine, it's really slows down my breathing, calms me, distracts me. And I think it's really helped me accept the presence of them in my life. I don't fight them now. I just let it come.
I wanted to ask you about that fighting thing. What do you mean by fighting them?
Fighting them is you notice that it's coming on. You feel this pressure and tightening and pain. And immediately you're angry because clearly you have plans.
Crap, whatever I planned, I can't do now.
Exactly. So right. You have to now make, you know, change appointments, cancel social visits or whatever. And then you immediately take something because, you know, either Tylenol or Motrin or whatever to begin
with.
One
of the specific drugs, yeah.
Yeah. And then if it starts to get worse, then you take your migraine drugs. And then the migraine drugs can really make you sleepy and right. They slow you down. You're in bed. So that's what you do. You start to fight it. because you immediately feel the guilt and anger. But now I'm like, okay, here they are. I don't think too much about it. If I have to change, you know, my day's schedule, I just change it and mm-hmm. go with the flow.
And you know that you can do something as wonderful as paint.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in the process, sort of that Zen process of painting. So I paint and I know what you mean. You have to be there, particularly if you're doing acrylics because it's going to dry.
Yes.
And you have to be there and just follow through with it and get it done. Do you do each painting in one sitting?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I'll at least begin the process, but I'm able to recall all my imagery.
How do you do that? I mean, you just,
otherwise,
that's just what you get to do.
Otherwise, my memory is pretty short, but when it comes to these migraine images, I seem to remember them all.
Do you make sketches?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
If I'm bedridden, I have a little book by my bedside and I'll quickly scribble. I don't even look at the page.
Yeah.
I'll just scribble whatever I think I'm seeing. And what I see, actually, it's almost like a movie. And my paintings, I could get multiple paintings out of a single migraine.
There is a lot of movement in your paintings.
Yeah. So depending on how I frame a portion of that image, and it's very dimensional. It's extremely textural. And trying to capture what actually goes on in the mind, I'm slowly, I think, getting better with it.
What kind of reactions do you get from people when you display, you know, publicly? So at the Columbus Arts Festival, you had to have people, migraines are common.
Yes. So people are completely fascinated with it. And I get two sets of people, mm-hmm. those that have migraines or know of someone with a migraine and they're fascinated with what I do. And others that are initially drawn to the color because my works are very colorful. Mm-hmm. And then when they find out where they come from, they are really uncomfortable and don't want to look at them anymore.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think it reminds them, people know that migraines are so painful and so debilitating. So once they find out that's where they come from, they just don't want to think about it. So I think that's a way for people to handle pain is to not think about it or ignore it, you know?
How many people, you actually put it up that it's migraine mm-hmm. art. How many people respond to that and just come up and look at it just because they're curious about what in the world this is?
I would say at least 60-70%. And because I call myself migraine artist, people want to know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
So it's allowed me to really have beautiful conversations with people. And I appreciate you having me here today, too, because one of the things I really want to stress and talk about and spread the message of is to do something creative when dealing with chronic pain or stress or some kind of a life situation that's an interrupter. You don't have to be a skilled artist. It could be anything, doodling, cartooning, knitting, something, you know. And the process of doing that really changes you on the inside. It makes you calmer and settles you more.
I know people think I'm crazy because sometimes if I'm talking on the phone during an interview, I doodle a lot. And it does. It keeps me focused
yes.
on the conversation. It doesn't distract me. It's not because I'm bored.
Yes. And I think that's something that over time, because of our, you know, educational system, our teachers in particular, you know, they don't like you doodling when you're in class. You know, at least that's how I grew up.
Yeah, it's how I grew up, too. I would sneak my doodles.
You know, you would be called a daydreamer. Or,
yeah, right.
It was not appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it actually helps people.
What, you've had these migraines since you were 6 or 8 years old?
Yes.
As a child, how did you cope with them?
As a child, I remember just throwing up and laying in bed for hours, just not being able to do anything for several hours, being so very tired. At that time, I didn't realize that this was something that could be handled or controlled better with diet or focused breathing. This is something I've just learned in my 40s now.
How did it occur to you to paint? Was that moment? What was that aha moment?
I don't know whether it was a deliberate, thought-out thing. I've always painted. I've always created. That's just something very innate to me. That's how I like to express myself. And my mind, I'm a very visual person anyway, so I'm always thinking in visual terms.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was just something natural for me. It is not a thought-out process that, okay, now I want to paint.
Uh-huh. And are there particular, I know that there are metallics in a lot of your work.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of that texture that you're looking for?
Yes, and part of the shimmer that I see.
Yeah, the shimmer. Right.
Yes. So I see bursts of light or a lot of shimmer, and all these layers kind of move and dance separately in a way. It's a beautiful, I mean, I don't think I have quite the skills to capture everything that I see, but I'm trying.
And how has, you said it's become more colorful, so mm-hmm. it's actually changing what you see, you mm-hmm. think. We don't know, but mm-hmm. we think it's changing what you see when you close your eyes during a migraine. When did that start?
I think it was about a year, 14 months into the process of painting. It was almost, I think, giving myself permission to not be afraid in a way,
mm-hmm.
because it's a, sort of like a dreamlike state that I'm not necessarily controlling, but perhaps I am. And now that I paint, I'm not afraid anymore. So I just let whatever unfolds to unfold.
Do you paint in a dark room?
No.
Did I read that you put sometimes have ice packs on your head?
Yes,
though?
I do.
What else is kind of maybe different?
So I have found this ice cap actually that you don't, you know, it's Velcroed that you just put it on your head so your hand's free. I have my migraine glasses.
Which are what?
They are the special light blocker glasses, the blue light blockers.
Oh,
so,
okay.
They really help diminish the intensity and glare of natural light.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll paint in the dark. It's not completely dark, of course. You kind of get used to that low light.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
And what about your family? I mean, has this helped your quality of life? Because I read that, you know, for years, all your kids knew was mom might have a migraine, and that was that.
Yes. So they are very supportive. They have always grown up with this. We make plans, and, you know, the three of my, I have two children, two boys, and my husband would take the kids and go, and I would be home. And even when we travel, sometimes I'm in the hotel by myself. But I think they really didn't understand what was going on in the head. Perhaps I didn't explain to them properly. All they knew of is the dominant pain symptom, and I would throw up or feel tired and lethargic. But they didn't quite understand until I started painting. And now they're blown away by what I see, and they find it really fascinating. In fact, my younger son gets migraines too. Mm-hmm. And he sees imagery as well, but not quite like this.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it'll evolve over time. I don't know.
Yeah. You travel around the country?
Yes.
How's that going?
We love to travel. So I make plans all the time. I go. I'm fascinated by new experiences and new cultural things I might, you know, encounter.
And if you get a migraine while you're on the road,
does
your husband help?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think I could do any of this without my husband.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we have to pull over, make an unexpected stop. I have the we grab ice. I have my shorts with me in my bag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do they sell? How do your paintings sell?
They're not. I mean, I do sell, but not like I'm not a. I can't make a living from this.
Mm-hmm. It's a sideline.
Yeah.
And how big do they get? Right now we're looking at, what, 12 inch by?
Yes, that's about 11 by 14.
Okay.
The largest I've gone is 5 feet by 4 feet.
Oh, okay. How do you determine how big it's going to be?
I think it's just the drama that I feel. It's like an emotional connection to a given image. And sometimes I feel like the beauty of it may not come in a smaller piece. It needs to be big.
Email from David, who writes, pain has driven art forever. Some of the most beautiful pieces of art were created because pain drove the artist to reflect what caused the pain and how they felt. Picasso, Guernica, so on and so forth.
Yes.
So there's a long history of it. You have a book. What's the name of the book?
It's called Migraine Visions, Transforming Pain into Beauty.
Migraine Visions, Transforming Pain into Beauty. We'll have a link to that as well on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. In the meantime, Priya Rama, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Priya Rama is an artist. She uses the pain of her migraines to create her art. If you want, you can check out the Facebook page, and we've got some examples on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, so check that out. It's beautiful. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The World Health Organization last week announced that video game addiction falls into the category of a mental health disorder. That means better health treatments for those who need it, but the decision has not resolved controversy within the mental health profession about whether gaming addiction is a disorder. Joining us now to talk about that is psychologist and media researcher at Stetson University in DeLand, Florida, Christopher Ferguson. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on today.
First of all, help us with the distinction here. When the World Health Organization puts it in the mental health disorder category, what difference does that make?
Yeah, it really makes a difference mainly for insurance. So if the disorder is not in a book like either the World Health Organization's ICD, which is the International Classification of Diseases, or the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, it basically can't be reimbursed. So you can go into a treatment center for something like gaming addiction, but you would have to pay – either you would have to pay out of pocket or they would have to diagnose you with some other condition like depression or anxiety in order to get reimbursed for the treatment. So this would at least begin to open the door. And it's not like it's going to all of a sudden happen tomorrow, but this begins the process of possibly allowing treatment providers to get directly reimbursed for treating gaming disorder.
Does it matter in the United States, though, since it's the World Health Organization here? It's not the United States book.
Yeah, that'll be something to watch for. The United States does use the ICD for sort of medical disorders, but yeah, for psychological disorders in the United States, the American Psychiatric Association's DSM is a lot more influential. So most insurance coding for mental health involves the DSM. And right now, the American Psychiatric Association does not have an official diagnosis for a gaming addiction or gaming disorder thing. They have a category for future study, but it is not yet an official diagnosis.
So there's a concern out there that this diagnosis doesn't have a foundation in solid research. What did the World Health Organization base it on then?
That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, obviously, I can't speak for the World Health Organization. I mean,
what do you know about what they were thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think their perception is probably a complicated one. I mean, I think that, some of the exchange has gone back and forth between some of the scholars who study this and the World Health Organization is that, they assembled, a group of people who study this who sort of agreed with them but didn't consult with people who are more skeptical of the disorder. So I think that there was a combination of issues that, I think in some of their correspondence, the World Health Organization has agreed that the research basis is not that great. But I think their argument is that, people are being treated for it right now, and having a diagnostic category might actually, incentivize better research or incentivize, better research into treatment or things like that. That's a perception that a lot of scholars disagree with, but I think that seems to be their stance. There also are some critiques, and there were some hints that there might have been some political pressure on the World Health Organization, and in their words, particularly from Asian countries, to make this happen. So that has added to, the perception that, I don't think anybody says that the World Health Organization is acting in bad faith, but, that there may have been a combination of issues that may have led them to perhaps prematurely label this as an official diagnosis.
Well, we know that at least it's a more visible problem in places like South Korea and Japan, right?
Yeah, it certainly gets talked about a lot, and it's not really sure that the prevalence is necessarily higher in these other countries or not, because there are a lot of differences between the way that research is conducted there versus in the United States or Europe, for instance. Mm-hmm. One of the things that of course is happening is in certain countries like China, of course, and then South Korea, they already have laws or policies on the books that are trying to curtail people's access to and particularly youth access to the internet or computers or games or things like that. And probably the most famous one is South Korea has a shutdown law that attempts to prevent minors from accessing the internet between, I believe it's midnight and 6 a.m.
And it's because of gaming.
Well, I think just because of the internet use in general. I think, okay. You know, everything from gaming to YouTube to, you know, everything else they may do online. And mm-hmm. the perception is, of course, that, you know, kids need this time to, you know, to sleep and be disconnected from technology and everything else. But mm-hmm. There actually was a study last year that came out on the South Korea's shutdown law that suggests that it's not at all effective, actually. I think they said that kids are sleeping like a minute and a half more now than they did before the law. So it's, you know, not a tremendous impact.
What is it about video games that is addictive from what you understand about the arguments?
There's probably it's sort of complicated. There's probably not anything particularly unique about games that make them addictive. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, people can overdo a variety of activities that are pleasant. So I mean, that's part of the big, you know, kind of debate that goes back and forth. Is there something about games that make them uniquely addictive, or mm-hmm. is it just that you have kind of like addictive personalities who tend to overdo things that are fun and have difficulty disengaging from them? The evidence we have now suggests that there probably isn't anything unique about gaming. In other words, you know, some people definitely overdo gaming, but they overdo exercise and work and shopping, and there are papers on like tanning addiction and dance addiction and all kinds of other things.
Wait,
so,
tanning addiction?
Yeah, there are papers on tanning addiction.
Oh, tanning. Okay,
tanning,
gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and dance addiction, which is actually kind of an interesting one. Right now, there doesn't seem to be anything. I know people kind of talk about, well, maybe the mechanisms of gaming is, you know, makes them more addictive. Right now, we don't have data to suggest that. That might change with some mechanisms. Like people are looking right now, there's something called a loot box that looks a little bit more like gambling, and people are kind of wary about that. But right now, we don't have any data.
Well, I was going to compare it to gambling. Is it hitting the same sort of pleasure spots that gambling does? Like whatever that is in your brain that they say reflects a gambling addiction.
Yeah, right now the differences between gaming and gambling are probably too wide to really kind of make that comparison. Gaming, for the most part, works on what we would call a continuous reinforcement schedule, which means it's mostly fun all the time. Whereas gambling tends to be much more intermittent. You know, it's like the slot machines. You have to keep putting the quarters into the slot machine in hopes that eventually you'll get rewarded for it. Yeah. And that's where people kind of a little bit worry about the loot boxes, however, in games, is that they look a little bit more like gambling because you don't always get rewarded for them. And you have to pay for them, and you don't know what you're going to get back. And so it looks a little bit more like a gambling type of exchange. We don't have any more, we don't really have any data on them because they're kind of new. So we don't really know that they have, you know, any particular greater impact than traditional gaming does, but it's possible that they might be. It's also important to point out that we do hear a lot about this idea of like the pleasure centers of the brain and dopamine. And, you know, sometimes you hear like, you know, games are like digital cocaine or whatever else. It's important to point out that everything fun activates these areas of the brain. So like literally, I've facetiously have mentioned that, you know, technically it's true that games, you know, release dopamine just like cocaine does, but quite literally so does stroking a cat, you know, or eating a pizza or reading a book that you enjoy, you know, and so sometimes something that's kind of a normal process is highlighted in a way to make it sound a lot more extreme than it actually does. Now, things like cocaine and methamphetamine release like massive amounts of dopamine in the brain, whereas video games are more similar to eating a pizza or reading a book or, you know, having sex or stroking a cat or whatever it is that you may enjoy. So there doesn't seem to be anything particularly pathological in the way that games release dopamine in the brain, even though sometimes in news headlines they make it sound like that's the case.
Well, I imagine there was a day when people thought the idea of a gambling addiction was ridiculous.
Yeah, the gambling addiction has been around for a while, and you know, I'll be quite frank and say before my time.
Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, I wasn't around for the you know, the controversies over, you know, gambling addiction. The one thing I will say is that I think, you know, one of the risks that come up when we start talking about sort of behavioral overuse disorders, whether it's gambling or gaming, is that really begins to open a door to this perception that anything is possibly addictive. And I think there's, you know, a reasonable question to ask, are we really conceptualizing this the right way? You know, is there something about, you know, gambling or gaming or food or sex or cats that, you know, really, you know, hooks people into them and takes a person who's perfectly fine and makes them into an addict. Now we know things like cocaine and methamphetamine have biochemical processes of tolerance and withdrawal and such that, you know, really do have a physical impact on people's brains. But it's harder to make that connection with things like, you know, gambling or gaming or, you know, other activities that are fun. So the question really is out there, are these really, you know, unique individual mental health diagnoses, or is it better to conceptualize these in the sense of like an addictive personality? You have some individuals that have a pre-existing issue with mental health, and that may involve them having difficulty regulating, you know, activities that are pleasant, being able to return to, you know, sort of things they have to do in life, whether that's work or school or family or chores or whatever else. And, you know, it's kind of, even we kind of know this. I mean, we kind of say even with gambling that, you know, make sure you kind of limit how much you spend and have a plan and this kind of stuff for when you go in, and most people can gamble. And, you know, we wouldn't say that for heroin. You know, make sure you have a plan for how much heroin you're going to use. And, there is a distinction there. And I think that's the concern a lot of people have is that, you know, in some ways, groups like the WHO have kind of become like addicted to disorders in a way, and we're kind of creating more and more and more disorders that may be kind of bringing us further off the path of what really is the issue. And these people probably have a real mental health condition, but whether it's gaming or, for that matter, gambling that did it to them, or did they have a pre-existing depression, anxiety, or something else that was going on for them that we really should be focusing in on, I think is still an open question.
We're talking about the World Health Organization's pronouncement that video game addiction is a mental health disorder. It's not necessarily the case in the United States, but my guest is Christopher Ferguson. He's a psychologist and media researcher at Stetson University in DeLand, Florida. What do you think? We've got a few minutes, so give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have some insight into this, do you think you're addicted? Do you know somebody who you think is addicted? Give us a call. You know, when you talked about the why this matters, it matters in the United States. If it goes into the DSM book, that means that it's covered by insurance or could be covered by insurance in so much as anything psychological is covered by insurance these days. But you said, you know, people get around that by just being diagnosed with, you know, depression, anxiety, whatever, you know, fits the bill. How might or what do we know about when people are treated for video game addiction, or if that's their addiction, whatever it might be, how would the treatment differ?
Yeah, that's actually a really excellent question. So, I mean, the issue we have right now with, you know, gaming disorder is, we don't know how to define it. We really don't have a list of symptoms that everybody agrees is, you know, indicative of gaming disorder. And the WHO got around that by simply not listing symptoms. They just said
it's something
that exists. Now you can, you know, so they really, in some ways, I mean, they said, you know, it's gaming that interferes with, you know, other aspects of a person's life. But that's actually really super broad, and it kind of leaves it to clinicians to decide, you know. So if you have a parent and a kid who are arguing about, you know, is the kid gaming too much, does that in and of itself become interference and, you know, become worthy of diagnosis? And, you know, it's really kind of left up to the clinician to imagine, you know, when the condition exists or does not. So as a result, we don't have any empirically validated treatments for gaming disorder. We can't, because we can't even agree what it is. You know, so that means that, you know, there is this kind of risk that if you go yourself or bring your child to a gaming disorder clinic, if you will, that you have no idea what you're getting, and you have no idea that what you're getting is actually going to be terribly helpful. And one of the controversies that, you know, some scholars have pointed out is that there's a risk that, you know, if the evidence suggests that, you know, people are starting with depression and anxiety or autism spectrum disorders and then develop, you know, kind of overuse of gaming, if you bring them in to treat their gaming, you may have some clinics that successfully reduce their gaming frequency but don't do anything to treat the underlying depression, anxiety, whatever else, you know, call it a success and send your kid back to you with full-blown clinical depression, and all they really did was take the coping mechanism away, you know. And, you know, so that's a potential problem. And my advice would be, you know, to parents, you know, if you're concerned that your kid is overusing games or anything else for that matter, I would advise bringing the child to, you know, a psychiatrist or psychologist who specializes broadly in children or adolescents, mm-hmm. you know, not specifically to a gaming disorder clinic at this point in time, you know, where those clinicians will be able to, you know, do a full assessment of the person, you know, be able to implement, you know, empirically validated treatments for the wide range of issues that child may be having. You know, and which may include reducing gaming frequency, but hopefully wouldn't be limited to that. Because I think with the gaming disorder clinics, you get into that phenomenon that, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. And you know, that might not always be very helpful.
Russell in Canal Winchester, you're on the air with Christopher Ferguson. Hi, Russell.
Hey, I love your show. And I'm an old gamer from the 80s.
Yeah.
And I just remember when I was playing video games, it always would raise my heart rate. And I'd be so excited. I couldn't wait to spend more of my money. And I know I've spent probably thousands of dollars even when the first video games came out. And, of course, the games today are way more advanced.
What was your game, Russell?
Well, my first one was probably, I would say, Space Invaders and then Pong. And, like, you know, you have Pac-Man and all that good stuff. But I spent lots of money, and I wasted so much money and time. And I see my children doing the same thing. And I feel like it's almost like it could be linked with attention deficit, because everything's so exciting and so fun. When you go to school, everything's boring.
You know, we have an email from Charles. Yeah. Well, we have an email from Charles who's asking the same thing, if there's a connection between ADHD and game addiction. Russell, thanks for the call. What do you think, Christopher Ferguson?
Yeah, the evidence suggests that there is. Yeah. So, and, you know, we've done some studies here at Stetson that have, you know, pretty much found exactly what the two callers or the caller of the email are referring to, that there does seem to be an issue where kids who, again, have sort of a pre-existing issue with ADHD, you know, tend to have more difficulties regulating fun activities. So they can get kind of locked into, you know, playing games more or doing other activities that are fun, and have more difficulty sort of breaking off of that and doing homework or going to school or doing activities that are less fun. And the caller, I think you said his name was Russell, you really kind of hit onto this issue that there is this thing that, you know, part of the problem is, of course, that a lot of the rest of the world isn't that fun. You know, that, you know, school really isn't that entertaining and work isn't that entertaining, you know. So on one hand, there, you know, there is this issue that, you know, games and other activities can be a lot more entertaining, but, you know, there also is a legitimate concern that sometimes, you know, the things that we want or need people to do, we haven't designed those very well. And there's a whole movement of this idea of gamification, essentially, you know, trying to make things
everything
like school
a game.
Work. Yeah, basically, to try to incentivize people more. But, you know, but there is that element that, you know, I think a lot of us can sympathize with this idea that sometimes it really is just hard to discontinue something fun in order to do something you have to, but most of us can do it. But you do get certain populations of individuals who struggle with that more than the average person does. And certainly people with ADD would be in that category.
Okay. Well, Christopher Ferguson, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Not a problem. It was a pleasure being on.
Christopher Ferguson is a psychologist and media researcher at Stetson University in Florida. We've been talking about the World Health Organization pronouncement that there is such a thing as video game addiction, and that it is a mental health disorder. Not everyone agrees. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Our health needs change as we age, mentally, physically, and emotionally. Founding editor of the New York Times Well blog, Tara Parker Pope, recently put together a midlife wellness tune-up guide. We'll post a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Tara Parker Pope joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide it was time for a guide? Because just so many of us are aging now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I tend to write about what I know and what interests me, and I'm turning 52 soon, and I'd like to define that as midlife. Not everybody would. But, you know, I talk to a lot of people, and I just find that you know, the kind of conventional thinking around health and wellness is just not working for people. You know, it's just to starve yourself and exercise a ridiculous amount. And it's just, life is just too complicated. And I find that people are really also looking inward more now. The world's gone a little nuts, and they're just trying to, you know, help, you know, find happiness how they can, when they can. And so it just felt like the right time to come up with this idea of a tune-up, because whether you're 30, 40, 50, or older, there's always small things you can do for yourself that can make really big difference in your health.
Sometimes people think it's just too late. I've never been an exerciser. I've never really been good at keeping a good diet, you know, eating healthily. And what difference does it make now? I'm 50, 55. Isn't it too late?
It makes such a difference. I mean, you can, you know, you can lose, you know, 5 or 10% of your body weight, or just, you know, changing to more healthful eating can make a big difference in how you feel. I mean, the goal here in health in general, and I think what people are realizing is there's no, I would actually say there is a fountain of youth. The fountain of youth is clearly exercise, but there's no way you can necessarily, I don't know what tomorrow holds for my health, but what I want to do is I want to live well every day. I want to certainly have more years to my life. If that's out there for me, that's wonderful. But at the very least, I want more life in my years. And I want to know that every day I'm feeling well, I'm happy, I'm doing, you know, what's right for myself, my body, my family, and that I'm just, you know, getting the most out of this wonderful experience that we call life. And so I think that's why a tune-up is a good idea, because you can always make a small difference in your day and your health. And how you, and wellness is about how you feel right now. And you can certainly make a change there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking with Tara Parker Pope. She's the founding editor of the New York Times Well blog, and she has put together a kind of a tune-up for middle age wellness on multiple levels. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Tara, I remember I interviewed the authors of Younger Next Year, kind of a seminal book about, you know, the fact that actually you have to exercise more as you age, not less, which seems to be the way most of us approach it, that you got to get up to 5 or 6 and maybe even 7 days a week of some kind of exertion, some kind of real exercise.
So there's really good news from the exercise world these days.
Right.
There's a lot of interest in, it's unfortunately named high-intensity interval training, which I think is a terrible name because that's so intimidating. It's really just short, fun, fast interval training. You increase the intensity of your exercise for a very short time. It's actually quite fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've shown that as we age, this kind of exercise actually reaps more benefits. It affects us at the cellular level, and if you are, you know, 30, you get a certain number of benefits, but if you're 50 and 60 and do this, you know, the sort of proportionally, you get a much greater impact. And the thing about interval training, it's very intimidating, and people think, oh, that's really for athletes, but mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to do this, and all I did was warm up on a bike for 3 minutes. I put on a heart monitor. So, you know, your last interview was talking about gaming,
yeah.
And I think what's fun about when you put on a heart monitor, you're sort of in a game with yourself, and I put on a heart monitor and, you know, looked at my baseline heart rate, and then I did a very brief 3-minute warm-up, and the coach I was working with said, okay, all out for 3 minutes, see what happens. And I was like, 3 minutes, I can totally do that.
Hmm.
So I sort of, you know, pushed myself hard on the bike for 3 minutes, and I got my heart rate up to like 140, 145, and then he's like, okay, 3 minutes rest. I'm like, excellent, I definitely needed the rest.
Do that.
And then he said, okay, 3 more minutes, after, you know, during the rest period, he said, 3 more minutes, but now beat your last number, beat your 145. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And I started pumping, and I watched my heart rate, and it was a nice distraction from the pain. And the thing about intensity exercise is you're not supposed to get into the pain zone. They want you in the discomfort zone. And discomfort is when, you know, they want you to the point where if I'm talking to you, I need to take a breath, and then I need to, you know, then I can continue my sentence. And, you know, if I can just talk to you freely, that's pretty moderate.
Right.
If I can sing, I'm really not working very hard at all. But if I'm talking to you and, you know, trying to finish my sentence and I have to gasp for air, I'm right in that discomfort zone. So it's a really good way to know where, if you're exercising at the right level for just this short period of time. So I would really encourage your listeners to try this. Get on an exercise bike or a rowing machine or a treadmill or a stair climber, whatever you like. And 3 minutes of easy warm-up, 3 minutes intense, add the heart monitor, but you go three on, three off. You know, you do that four times. And so for me, I went from what I thought was my hardest level at 145 heart rate, and I pushed myself up to about 166 by the fourth interval. And then I got a nice 3 minute moderate cool down and a 2 minute easy cool down. And it was fun to watch my heart rate drop. It was great. It changed my life. I thought, I can do interval exercise, and it's really, really good for you, and it takes such a short amount of time.
You talked about the seven-minute workout, and I like the seven-minute workout because I can transport it with me. I don't need equipment, and I can, you know, I know I'm getting a good workout if I do it for like 21 minutes to, you know, 30 minutes.
The thing about the seven-minute workout is it's the least amount of time you can spend on exercise and really give yourself a benefit. So if you really don't have time, give yourself that 7 minutes. We can all carve out 7 minutes. The story I wrote about the seven-minute workout, I find the traditional seven-minute workout very difficult. As you age, you know, I've got kind of knee issues and I have wrist issues. And so some of these exercises are, even though they're simple, they're hard. I have a knee injury right now and jumping jacks are really painful. So I went in and talked to the Chris Jordan, the guy who created the 7 minute workout. And I said, okay, what's like the, for people who really are struggling, give me the simplest exercises that I can do, but still get the benefit. So, you know, instead of a jumping jack, you're looking for an exercise from each muscle group. So you really only need four exercises. You need a cardio exercise, a lower body, an upper body, and a core. And you do each one for 30 seconds, and you take a 5 or 10-second rest in between, whatever works for you. If you take a 10-second rest, it becomes an 8-minute workout. A 5-second rest is a 7-minute. So on your cardio, you know, you can just do high knees or march in place, but what you want to do is stand and box, but you want to do that at an intensity level. Push yourself for those 30 minutes so that you're really marching in place and working, you know, getting your heart rate up. That's what we're trying to do. 5-second rest, lower body, you know, you can do a chair squat, you can do a lunge, a wall, you know, a wall sit is a common one in the 7 minute workout, but if the wall sit's too hard, just do a lunge. Again, 30 seconds at intensity. Upper body, this is hard for me. I can't do a standard push-up, but I can do a kneeling push-up. I can do a wall push-up if you've got knee issues. Wall push-up sounds really easy, but you know what? If you do it hard and fast for 30 seconds, you're doing well. And then, you know, 5-second rest and core. You can do a plank, you can do an abdominal crunch, a Superman where you're lying on your stomach and you're lifting your arms and your feet like you're flying like Superman. These are not hard. Even if you have an aging body, you can do these things. And again, a 7 minute workout is just picking those four exercises that work for you, doing them for 30 seconds, resting for 5 seconds, and repeating that sequence three times. It's not that hard. It's really, and I think that's what's exciting about exercise science right now. Instead of, you know, going and killing yourself for 2 hours, they're finding a way for you to really give yourself the biggest benefit in a really short period of time.
Well, I know, and I think you touched on this a little bit, the high intensity training, despite the intimidating label associated with it, is I get bored just on a bike, you know, in the gym or on a treadmill or anything like that. I don't even really like running that much. I'd rather do that, change it up, keep changing it up.
And it is, and I think it's been unfortunately named. I'm on a one woman campaign to change the name to FIT, to fun fast interval training, because it is interesting. It is fun, and it's accessible. It's actually more accessible. I am much more able to do an intensity workout than I am able to go run 5 miles. And it's less hard on your body, and you can adjust if you need to, if, you know, things are hurting. And I'm a big believer. So one of the things I would suggest in your midlife tune-up is to just give this a go. And if you're not sure, you know, go to a, you know, you can go and talk to a trainer about it if you want, but you don't have to. You can just do the 7 minute workout in your living room. You can do, you know, SoulCycle is it basically an interval train. You know, go to a beginner's class if that sounds fun. You'll have music and you'll have good company there. Working out in groups is a great idea. There's a lot of benefit to community when you're trying to get fit. So I would suggest that for people.
What do we eat? I mean, to me, the eating thing is something that people should be following throughout their life. But I think you brought up a really interesting topic when you said stop drinking our flavors. I mean, I know people who say, oh, I drink water, but I like to put a flavor in it.
You know, I find this really interesting. We Western cultures are really the only ones who we want to drink flavored, you know, liquids. Most people drink water to sustain their bodies, you know, to quench their thirst. and they're really appreciative of clean, fresh water. You know, I think we've been taught by the food industry that we need to change water into something sweet and syrupy, and that we've, and we're teaching our children this, unfortunately, that drinks should be flavored. I think it's a really simple thing. Look, here's the thing. Dieting, the concept of dieting does not work, because the idea of dieting means that you're going to try an eating plan and you're going to try to reach a weight, and then the moment you get there, you're just going to go back to your old habits.
Mm-hmm.
It's never worked for any of us, so why do we keep trying to do it? And I think one of the great things of middle age is you get a little bit smarter about life. And what I've learned and what has happened for me in the past year is I really did give up dieting, because there's so much evidence that dieting wrecks your body, and mm-hmm. that you get almost this post-dieting syndrome, so that your body doesn't quite work correctly anymore. It's fighting against you. So I did a few really simple things. I stopped eating packaged food. No more packaged food. If I have to have a packaged food, like maybe I need to buy almonds and that comes in a package, or yogurt comes in a package, I want one ingredient on my package, maybe two. Maybe there's the second one that needs to be there. But really don't eat anything in a package. You know, think about it as a container. You might need a container, but if you're opening a crinkly package, that's just a big sign that you shouldn't be eating it. So no more packaged foods. Really stop eating sugar. Stop eating added sugar. You're going to eliminate a ton of added sugar when you stop eating packaged foods.
Mm-hmm.
That's really 90% of it right there. But this idea, you know, don't drink your flavors. Drink water. You know, next time you want to reach for something flavorful, just say, you know what, I'm just going to get a nice cool glass of water. Or a room temperature glass of water if you're European. And if that's not enough, you know, then maybe you want to add a little, you know, fruit. I'm really a big believer in these. You know, you go to nice hotel lobbies and they have this water with fruit infused in it.
It really makes a difference.
It's delicious. It's wonderful. And you feel like it's such a treat. So do that for yourself. If you want to, you know, the money you'll save on buying soda and all that, you can go buy yourself one of those nice pitchers with a fruit infuser. But it's such a simple way to treat yourself and be kind to yourself. And again, the other trick that I think is really important is finding a high protein snack. So nuts are a really good one. You don't want to overdo it. You want to eat like 8 or 9 almonds. But it's really amazing to me how I'll be sitting at my desk and I'll be really craving something, and I'll just eat 5 or 6 nuts, and it just does eliminate the craving. So I think what's important about midlife is strategies. You know, you want to have eating strategies, but you want a lifestyle of eating. The last thing I say in this tune-up is to love your vegetables. We're so stingy with our vegetables in this country. Like, we boil green beans, and I'm like, you know what, sear them in a pan, make them, you know, throw in some olive oil, some spices, make them taste delicious. Love your vegetables and savor them and enjoy them. We really messed up the way we're eating. You know, we're either denying ourselves or we're overindulging. But I'm like, overindulge in vegetables, which can be incredibly delicious. You know, if you really roast the heck out of a vegetable, it gets very sweet and you get to enjoy the natural sugar, and your kids will love it. So I just think we need to think about simple strategies rather than dieting. And for me, this is my life. My life is that I'm not going to eat packaged foods. Do I ever slip and have...
Of course.
You know, of course. But I also don't punish myself for it and say, oh, that's it. I've failed. I'm just only, you know, I'm never going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Just live your life and treat yourself. I think this idea of self-compassion, like... Mm-hmm. It's a really new concept for us. We're not always as nice to ourselves as we are to our friends. But, you know, one of the ways you can be nice to yourself is to fuel your body with healthful, delicious food. Do that because it's a good thing to do for yourself, because it's kind.
Well, Tara Parker Pope, there's lots more to talk about. I hope you'll join us again to do it.
I would love to. I love this topic, and I grew up in Ohio, so I love Ohio. So.
All right. Cool.
Take care. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks.
That's Tara Parker Pope. She's founding editor of the New York Times Well blog. We talk to people from that blog all the time. That is it for Wellness Wednesday today. So thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.